Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, microphone working okay? Tom, is it okay? Okay. Thanks for coming along tonight. We have Peter Cochran and Penelope Nelson on. Peter will speak first, followed by Penelope, and the general topic is early colonial society, Bligh and Wentworth. Now, both of our speakers have recently had books published. Peter Cochran's book, Colonial Ambition, Foundations of Australian Democracy, won the Age Book of the Year Prize in 2007 and was equal first in the Prime Minister's History Prize, which was announced also in 2007. He's the author of the critically acclaimed companion volume to the ABC TV series Australians at War, and also Simpson and the Donkey, The Making of a Legend. And he's currently at work on a new project, Governor Bligh's Factotum, about William Bligh's sojourn in the colony of New South Wales. And Penelope Nelson, who's addressed the Institute before on Flynn, John Flynn, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John Flynn of the Northern Territory and all that, was educated at the University of Sydney, Macquarie and New Mexico Tech. She lives in Sydney and she's the author of three novels and the memoir Penny Dreadful, and she's recently published Bligh's Daughter. So Anne's got some copies of Bligh's Daughter and Colonial Ambition outside, but now we start off with Peter Cochran, followed by Penelope Nelson, followed by questions and discussion. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That title, I should say, Governor Bligh's Factotum, refers to Andrew Thompson, who was Bligh's bailiff, is the other word, I think, at the Hawkesbury River. And I'm not going to talk about him tonight because I've only just got back to this project and I haven't got around to Thompson. I'm thinking quite a bit about Bligh. So what I wanted to do tonight was talk a little bit about writing about character, firstly in the case of colonial ambition, and then to link that up to thinking about writing on Bligh. Colonial Ambition was my attempt to tell the story of the struggle for self-government and democracy in New South Wales in the 1840s and the 1850s. In telling that story, I wanted the book to have two qualities that are not all that easy to reconcile. The first of these was solid scholarly foundations, and the second was a broad readership beyond the universities. To reconcile those two qualities, I decided, after quite a bit of experimentation, about a year's worth of swimming around in the record, I think, on a literary form that I've called biographical narrative. Colonial Ambition would be political history with a strong biographical thread, represented first and foremost by William Charles Wentworth, the first. I chose Wentworth for several reasons. Firstly, he was a colossus in the struggle for civil freedoms and self-government in the colony. Secondly, he was immensely talented. He was ferociously driven, and if I may say so, on my reading, he was deeply flawed. aren't we all? A fascinating character. And thirdly, the documentation of Wentworth's private or family life was rich enough to permit a dialogue between the public and private Wentworth, an extremely valuable means of understanding the nature of his political ambition. And I was trying to understand political ambition in general in that period, thus the title. So it was important to have, if I was going to have a kind of leading man or a core biographical thread running through the book, it was important to have that public-private link and to have it reasonably well documented so I could say something about, you know, the inner workings of the man, if you like. So, well, there was another point too. He was also, of course, he became the great exponent or the great opponent in the fight against democracy. He was our most distinguished, I guess, anti-democrat in that period. So that seemed, the idea of the anti-hero seemed like a nice, in just in terms of literary form, a nice way to go rather than to make the central character Henry Parkes or, you know, one of the better loved champions of democracy in that early period. So Wentworth was big enough, complex enough, and fascinating enough to carry the story as I began to understand it. I envisaged the book working like a double helix, with the political history progressing in a sort of binary fashion, winding around and through the biographical thread, if you like, and the thread getting thicker as I went, knitting in other characters who had to be there because they were also an important part of the story. And that included the women, I might say. When I began this, I was thinking, well, it's a public culture, it's a political culture at that period that's totally male-dominated. But I increasingly found evidence that the documentation almost conspires to keep women out of the story. But if you're looking, you do find evidence that women played a significant part in this period, even though they didn't have the vote. Just two examples. One, of course, is Sarah Wentworth, W.C. Wentworth's wife. She's tremendously important, I think, in shaping the ambitions of the family, which in turn, the ambitions for the children, which in turn profoundly affect Wentworth's attitude to his own political career and indeed his attitude to the colony, which he eventually turns against, I think, in a sense. The other example, I think, is women in electoral politics. It's very hard to find, but if you read all those marvellous tiny print accounts of electoral meetings in the elections of 1848, 51 and so on, you will find examples of women inserting themselves into the political process. And the best one that I came across was a case in the Parramatta election of 1848, when a woman saw William MacArthur, who was the candidate, William MacArthur's henchmen coming. The henchmen were the sheriff and one or two others, and they were garnering up votes. So she got her husband, and as she reported in the Herald, she hid him under the bed. And in they came, expecting to do what they did in those days. And sort of, you know, it's rotten borough politics in Britain. It's being reproduced out here. They expected to just rough arm him into voting for them, but they didn't on that occasion because he was under the bed. And she argued with them and got them out of the house. So I think there's a story there that is only a minor thread of my book, but I've tried to make it a thread nonetheless. So the idea was to revisit our political history in a new way, to tell it as a continuous, at least in that period, to tell it as a continuous interwoven drama of human lives. And one problem I was acutely aware of was the attitude in academe to narrative, the view that narrative was dumbing down or is dumbing down, that it is the first step into a sort of Hades of commercialisation, that it's not serious history. Question is, does narrative have to be like that? Does it have to be vacuous and lightweight? The difficulty arises, I think, from thinking or from the view that narrative skates along on the surface, or the idea that it skates along on the surface, dealing with plot, chronology, character, the flow of events and so on, while real historical scholarship is digging down deep below the surface into the structures and explaining how all that works, the idea being that the surface is somehow the kind of puppet of all those deeper processes. Now, I think it's true that narrative has to obsess with matters of character and literary form. The question is that compatible with deep analysis, engagement with big histories, with big issues in the discipline and so on? Can narrative writers obsess with the challenge of the story and also engage with the historiography as well? And my answer is yes, or at least it's yes, but it's hard. The novelist Thomas Mann once said, "A writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people." it certainly stopped me in my tracks when I read that. I had to sort of think, what is he saying here? But I think it's spot on. The narrative historian has to wrestle with the literary dimension as well as the problem of how the past has been defined, interpreted, ignored or mischaracterized by other historians. And in diagrammatic sense, I think what the narrative historian has to do is kind of move along that surface, telling the story, chronology, plot, the evolution of events, and somehow at the same time drag up those deeper analytical matters and embed them somewhat imperceptibly in the story, if you know what I mean. On that point, my second and final quote is from Julian Barnes' novel Flaubert's Parrot, where he says, "Form, meaning literary form, isn't an overcoat flung over the flesh of thought. It's the flesh of thought itself." And when I read that, I thought, thank you, Julian, you've written that for me. Which I take to mean, reading that line as a historian, that merging the two concerns, literary and historiographical, so that they're brought together seamlessly, as it were, is the real challenge. It's what Shimon Sharma called argument by stealth. And Colonial Ambition, I hope, is argument by stealth. That's to say, it's engagement with the discipline, but that engagement is embedded in an alluring story. That's my hope. That's the model I also hope to bring to bear on Bligh, which is now a project now revived as a result of, was put aside so that I could write on Wentworth and Co, but it's now revived. And Bligh's character, I have to say, is central to the project. What interested me in relation to his character most of all was how did something, this is sort of my first project that I want to try and solve, how did something as strange and excessive and exceptional as the rebellion of 1808 come to pass? And my conclusion is that Bligh's character and his behaviour is the main cause of the rebellion. If we look at Bligh's public performance as governor in Sydney between August 1806 when he arrived and January 1808 when the rebellion occurred, and if we examine the responses of local citizens, his subjects as it were, especially the New South Wales Court, the soldiers under him, we see how Bligh came to epitomise what the isolated residents of Sydney feared most, an unfettered tyranny. They had a good schooling in tyranny, of course, from their own history and from their vicarious experience of the seemingly unending war with France, Robespierre, the Terror, Napoleon, and periodic fears of invasion back in England. So here I just want to make a few observations on Bligh's character and draw them together in a conclusion that reflects a little on Sydney Town as much as it does on Bligh himself. Firstly, I think it's important to get a sense of the moral Bligh. He was high-minded in his professed inclinations and perfectionist in his standards. He was a man of faith, regular churchgoer with an impeccable private life, a wife whom he adored. The letters, it's a good thing that she stayed back in London because we have the letters. The letters are quite wonderful. Six daughters, all of this I'm sure Penny will talk about in much more detail than me. Four of them unmarried, I think. Four of them unmarried. And a cause for some financial concern. In that respect, it's a real Jane Austen story. I think, you know, he takes the job because they double the pay and he says, right, you know, I'll do what you want. I'll go out to New South Wales. He was in the mould of the new morality in patrician England, best symbolised by William Pitt. He despised obesity, squalor, lethargy, womanising and drunkenness, though Pitt was not so good on that last one. So whether alcoholism is drunkenness is, you know, I mean, Pitt seemed to operate pretty well. It's important to picture the total performance, the total Bligh performance, the theatricality and the force of his menace. He was prone, as I'm sure most of you know, to fly into a rage, to wave his arms and his fists and to match these actions with wild and threatening words. But it was not so much bad language as the threatening language that seemed to me to hit home. His trademark response to anything in Sydney, or just about anything, anything but compliance, was a barrage of threats. The precise detail unknowable until it scorched off his tongue. He might threaten to hang, behead or ruin a man, or thrash him, or exile him, or blow out his brains, or take his land, or destroy his home, or ruin his business. In Sydney, his violent and somewhat unhinged behaviour was mostly out of all proportion to the matter in hand when he did perform in that way. And in a sense, he confessed it himself. He said quite some time earlier, I just can't remember when it was, was either in relation to the bounty or the warrior court-martial, when he was court-martialed for bad behaviour in 1805, he said that he suffers from ebullitions of the mind, explosions of the mind. So was he mad? Well, Paul Brunton, who's here tonight, has guided me on this and made the crucial point that he absolutely was not mad, because he never behaved like this when he was talking to his superiors. The only time he quote-unquote lost himself, as one observer said, was when he was talking to people below himself, but he certainly did lose himself on many an occasion in Sydney. In Mr. Bligh's Bad Language, a wonderful book about Bligh and the Bounty by Greg Denning, Denning argued that Bligh's language was a problem not because it was intemperate or abusive, after all it was the 18th century, but because men could not find in it any sign, any familiar pattern of legitimate or acceptable authority. And so it was, I think, in New South Wales. One of his victims was a man called Alexander Berry, a merchant who brought a consignment of goods to Sydney to trade. Bligh worked him over. The account in the letter, if it's true, is really quite extraordinary. It was written much later, but it rings true and it fits with a lot of other evidence. He worked him over, he gave him a terrible time. He threatened, among other things, to ruin him and endanger the profitability of his enterprise. And Berry wrote, "I felt myself in a remote corner of the world. In the power of a lawless tyrant and cut off from every resource, I expected nothing but to be devoured." Now, there might be a bit of hyperbole there in the last bit, but the actual detail of the account that he writes is pretty horrifying, and as I say, I think it fits with the much bigger, much broader pattern that is really the sort of proof of the nature of the man. It's that epithet, lawless tyrant, that catches the eye, but so too does the phrase remote corner of the world, for Britons travelled the world trusting in the reach of British law, even to the far corners of empire, even to a place as far away as Sydney. There's just three main areas where this lawlessness manifested itself, and I'll summarise them. And I must say, when I use the term lawlessness, I'm using it loosely. There's a debate about whether Bligh broke any laws, and I can't cite specifically a law that he broke. I'm talking more about his disruption of established judicial procedures and established conventions in the colony, particularly in relation to how you treat soldiers and officers. After all, the rebellion was... There's no rebellion without the New South Wales Corps. So the three examples are, I'll just cite them, his interference in several important cases in the civil court, notably the case of the Irish exiles, Michael Dwyer and co, who came out here as free settlers. I mean, that was the deal, to get them out of Ireland. Set themselves up, they were respectable farmers, and Bligh wouldn't have it. He put them on trial, had them tried, and they were exiled yet again, I think, to the Hunter River settlement.
Norfolk Island.
Okay, thank you. Secondly, so there's that case and several others where Bligh just intervenes, and the response of people like Major Johnson and other officers in the court is that this is atrocious. Now, this is not to say that the judicial procedure in New South Wales, which was by and large run by the officers, was... entirely right and proper, but there was a procedure, and it was generally understood in Sydney that, particularly through the civil court, that this is where you settle debts, this is where you put things right one way or another. Secondly, there was his treatment of the New South Wales Corps, both officers and men, which was, I think, atrocious. And thirdly, there was his determination to reassert the rights of the Crown over the town leases, over the town leases and the land grants of Sydney, which resulted in, just to put it very briefly, Bligh basically marching around Sydney and telling people, some people, to pull their houses down. They were, soldiers and non-soldiers, they were traumatised, but I think more to the point, everyone who owned a house in Sydney was traumatised, and there's evidence of other people who weren't directly affected by this particular Bligh behaviour being quite worried that it would flow on to them. And as you know, you get between a Sydneyite and his real estate, and or her real estate. I say her real estate because one of the best letters on this was by Sarah Wills, who was the a free woman who was the wife of a convict who did write an account of how she was terrified that they would lose the land and of how Bligh's behaviour was utterly tyrannical. So they're the three sort of areas where I think it all came together. The key point is that no governor before or since has rattled the sanctity of private property as Bligh did. He did this in relation to the town lots and leases, and also he did it in relation to his strict curb on the grog trade, which has had a lot of attention by other historians in the past. Which, of course, takes us back to his character, because he was, in his rather Puritan attitude to grog, utterly committed to ending that trade in a way that previous governors who'd tried sort of ended up doing deals and compromising, etc. He had, in other words, he had orders to stop the grog trade, and it suited him to a T. It also fitted in with his anti-urbanism. He was anti-urban by inclination. It wasn't just grog, it was the town. He hated the moral character of Sydney. Cohabitation, the illegitimate kids, and there were an awful lot of illegitimate kids, the drunkenness, commercial greed. He just seemed to object to commerce in general. And, of course, the convict mistresses of quite a few of the officers. All that was just anathema. So he's quite happy to... It worked in really well with his own character to simply follow instructions and promote small farming in New South Wales at the expense of entrepreneurialism and commerce coming out of Sydney. Commercial Sydney, of course, the problem was it was all too late. Commercial Sydney was off and running. It was steeped in trade and graft, crude, boisterous, full of sin, litigious, avaricious, enterprising, unstoppable, everything that... I thought it had changed. Everything that Bligh stood for, Sydney was kind of the antithesis. Most of all...
Bringing back.
Well, apart from everything else, I have to say he was a good man.
He loved his wife.
He did indeed. Yes, as I said, the little one. Most of all, Sydney was a city overflowing, and I'll finish on this point. Most of all, Sydney was a city overflowing, brimming full of entrepreneurial ambition. Governor King had facilitated this, his predecessor, as best he could, knowing that emancipists needed to be employed in one way or another as they come out of servitude. Bligh didn't seem to get it. In the end, what we see is two very different visions. The extraordinary ambition and visions for New South Wales of that first generation of traders and entrepreneurs, as against Bligh's vision of a small farming backwater closed to everything but a penal future. And it's there, I think, that MacArthur's best fitted in, because always when we talk about Bligh, we seem to have to talk about MacArthur. And we do so as he is the great conspirator. He's the Svengali pulling the strings behind the office, etc. Well, maybe. I don't think he pulled too many strings. I think the rebellion would have happened anyway. And he was certainly part of it. There's no doubt about that. But MacArthur's best fitted into this picture, for me anyway, as a visionary. Someone who, if you look at his papers, or if you look at some of the secondary accounts of what he was like, imagined an Australia that was kind of a second empire. That Sydney would be a new London or Calcutta or something. And that from there, as early as 1806, he had a plan for a four-point, I think, trading rectangle between Sydney, Canton, Sydney, the Fiji Islands, Canton, Calcutta, and back to Sydney. And a lot of Simeon Lord, the emancipist trader, they were trying to do the same things. They were trying to set up this kind of entrepreneurial New Britannia in another world. And that's the way I think that MacArthur best fits into the Bligh story, as an outstanding if you know, a rather cunning and sneaky and conspiring component of the vision that Bligh ran up against when he came to New South Wales. And of course in January 1808, he ran up into it good and proper in the form of the rebellion carried out by the New South Wales Corps. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's rather fun to be talking to you just metres from Bligh's Government House. Although this is a Victorian cottage, the cottages that were along here behind Government House had stinking privies, and Bligh very much wanted them demolished. He did. There was an original Sydney plan that had been overlooked in the building of them. That was his story. My paper's called Bligh's Daughter, A Perspective on the Bligh Years. On a very sunny morning in December 1987, Sydney's only statue of William Bligh was unveiled at Circular Quay. It's between the Museum of Contemporary Art and Cadman Cottage. And it was unveiled by my late father, David McNichol, who'd spearheaded the campaign for that statue in the Bulletin, his late magazine. And there's a flatteringly slim William Bligh in bronze with a very long inscription. The last words are, "A brave and gallant man who was unlucky in his subordinates." In our century, we might question the emotional intelligence of a man with so much bad luck. We know that top-notch technical skills, and Bligh was one of the best navigators in history, don't always translate into good management of people. The mutiny on the Bounty made Bligh one of the most gossiped about men of all time. British policy remained suited to conditions of earlier years, the penal colony, whereas Bligh's dream was of a colony of law-abiding small farmers. He and his British superiors had little understanding of Sydney's fledgling trading economy, as Peter's just explained. He was inclined to see people who enriched themselves through trade as corrupt, and indeed in many cases their markups were steep and their practices sharp. And John MacArthur was a well-known Sydney businessman in the full tabloid sense of that word. He was talented, entrepreneurial, energetic, profit-oriented, quick to call for a duel, and not above sending in strong men to settle a score. I don't propose to go into detail about the armed rebellion. Suffice it to say that Bligh was lawfully appointed, believed he was carrying out his commission, and could be vindictive when he was challenged. My novel's called Bligh's Daughter. What I'll do is very briefly outline Mary's life and then discuss the largely neglected interregnum of 1808 and 09 and the controversy around Mary's second marriage and Bligh's initial fury about it. And I'll conclude with a few remarks about history and narrative and fiction. Aged 22 when she arrived, Mary, the second of Bligh's six daughters, acted as the colony's first lady from August 06 to January 1808. She was married to John Putland, a naval officer, and Bligh's aide-de-camp. She played the piano, landscaped Bennelong Point with trees, they had cabbages before that, and she became a patron of the orphan school. She caused a sensation one Sunday when pantaloons were visible under her sheer muslin dress, one of those Jane Austen numbers, very thin material. She nursed her dying husband at Government House. He had tuberculosis and was widowed just 3 weeks before the Rum Rebellion. And you can guess who the chief mourners were at his funeral, the very officers who led the rebellion on the 26th. On the night of the rebellion, she tried to repel 400 armed soldiers, and they had their bayonets drawn, with insults and a parasol. She spent years under... She could let fly with words as her father could. She spent a year under house arrest with her father in Government House and shared his days of incarceration at the barracks. Later that year, she endured months on the Derwent in HMS Porpoise. On her return to Sydney in early 1810, She was befriended by Elizabeth Macquarie and courted by Colonel Maurice O'Connell, Macquarie's deputy. Despite her father's initial refusal, she married O'Connell, becoming the mother of a large family. After serving in Ceylon and Malta, the O'Connells returned to Sydney in 1838, living at Tarmans on the Darlinghurst estate, where St Vincent's College, Potts Point, now stands. As a widow, she lived in Paris, the interregnum. Sydney was not a happy place in 1808 and 1809. Four people headed the government in turn: George Johnston, John MacArthur, Joseph Vaveau, and William Paterson. Bligh's supporters lost government jobs, and some were sent to Newcastle after farcical trials, some even to the coal mines. Guards manned the door of Government House and followed Bligh and Mary if they walked in the garden. The authorities communicated by frigid notes and various power plays. They helped themselves to the garden's best fruit and vegetables and sent one of the gardeners to unload ships with the town gang. Bligh was allowed eventually to see his friends, but he could not correspond freely with London. His self-justificatory documents, which he dictated non-stop to the tireless little Mr. Griffin, and letters had to be smuggled past the guards. Mary kept trying to keep her father cheerful, not easy as he was subject to migraines. One hot day in January 1809, officers of the Corps arrested Bligh, taking him to the army barracks then over near Wynyard. Mary followed from here on foot. On arrival, she refused to be parted from her father. After some days, Bligh gave an undertaking that he would sail directly back to England on the Porpoise. The Porpoise went north as far as Port Macquarie, then, to the dismay of officers and crew, Bligh sailed to Hobart. His motives are a puzzle. He mentioned not deserting his post without instructions from London. He also hoped for what he called succour, S-U-C-C-O-U-R. At times, he imagined armed ships arriving from London or India to overthrow the rebels. Bligh and the crew were welcomed at first, but the authorities turned against him on instructions from Sydney. Bligh loyalists who supplied the ship were flogged in Hobart. Again, the officers and crew imagined they were bound for London. But no. For month after cold, indecisive month, the Porpoise hovered at the mouth of the Derwent, keeping in sight of both the north and south shipping lanes. Flying the Bligh pennant rather than a pirate's skull and crossbones, the Porpoise summoned all shipping to come alongside while mail was inspected and stores commandeered. It was a miserable time. Relations were strained. Not too many people were speaking to Bligh. Uncertainty nagged at everyone. Some of the crew deserted. Lieutenant William Kent, once a Bligh loyalist by this time, he was a very young man, was under arrest for disloyalty to Bligh. He had the freedom of the ship, but that didn't mean a great deal. Mary endured an isolated existence. Distracted and edgy, Bligh took to his bed with migraines for days on end. At last, word came obliquely of Macquarie and the 73rd Regiment heading for Sydney. In January 1810, the Porpoise returned to Sydney Harbour. Macquarie was already here, and to Bligh's fury, he had taken command without waiting for his predecessor. There were instructions to reinstate Bligh for 24 hours. It didn't happen. Enraged Bligh. This is Mary's second marriage and my theories about that. Bligh reacted with disbelief and rage when he learned of Mary's intention to marry Colonel Maurice O'Connell, educated in France, brought up in an Irish Catholic family. He was fiercely opposed to the match. He had not seen it coming. The pair had not known each other long. O'Connell's very surname would have been enough to raise Bligh's hackles. The Irish were distrusted because of uprising in Ireland in the 1790s and the Vinegar Hill uprising at Castle Hill during Governor King's time. And in 1807, as Peter has told you, Bligh had sent suspects, not rebels, but suspects of further uprisings to Norfolk Island, and he'd sent his sick son-in-law to command the ship. However, on the 8th of May, 1810, Bligh gave away his daughter at Government House, just here, with a fairly good grace. And as the Reverend Samuel Marsden was officiating, we can be absolutely sure that the Church of England form was followed. How was Bligh's consent obtained? Mary and Morris, both adults, could have gone ahead without his blessing. The Macquarie supported the match. I believe there was an additional factor. Gavin Kennedy, author of Captain Bligh, The Man and His Mutinies, writes that Bligh's evidence at the court-martial of an officer named Williamson might be explained by some secret Masonic connection between the two. Masonic connections abound in this circle and are worth exploring. Lachlan Macquarie was a Freemason. Bligh's patron, Sir Joseph Banks, was a Mason. In letters to Banks, Bligh refers to God as, capital letters, the great architect. This is not the language of the Book of Common Prayer. Masonic rites begin with the words, "Brethren, in the name of the great architect of the universe, let us declare the lodge open." I can't prove that Maurice O'Connell was also a Mason, but around 1800, many military men and many Irish Catholics did belong to lodges. It's surely significant that Maurice O'Connell Jr., the O'Connell's eldest son, became the founding Grand Master of the Masonic Lodge of Queensland. When Bligh wrote to his wife Betsy of, quote, "many proofs of the honour, goodness and high character of Colonel O'Connell and his good sense which had passed under my own trial," the discovery that O'Connell was a fellow Freemason could have been one such proof. A hint would have been enough for the astute Betsy Bligh. The fact that he makes no mention of religion or nationality adds weight to my interpretation. History, narrative and fiction. Few subjects divide historians as fiercely as Bligh does. Mary is usually left out or caricatured with references to the parasol and the pantaloons. And I will admit that both those things do lend themselves to the odd jibe. One writer even extends hostility to Bligh to Mary herself. Helen Heaney, the author of Australia's Founding Mothers, writes, "though she committed no crime, she, of all her contemporaries, most strongly resembled Lady Macbeth." Heaney bases this judgment on William Nicholas's unglamorous portrait of Mary in later life. The National Library now owns this portrait, a companion piece to one of Maurice O'Connell, part of an army commission. Mary's crime, apparently, was to share her feelings about her father's enemy with her husband. Lachlan Macquarie and his wife tried to paper over the divisions of the Bligh years. "Let bygones be bygones" was the motto of the time. Macquarie had good reasons for moving forward with all the talent available to him, regardless of background. But such a failure of imagination about the previous few years by somebody writing women's history is frankly astonishing. I believe that it's pointless to set up category wars between academic history, narrative history, and historical fiction. At the Sydney Writers' Festival last year, Tom Griffiths, a historian from the Australian National University, reminded us that many historians were originally switched on to history by historical fiction. We all have our favourites. Recent research by Anna Clark shows that students in our high schools are alienated and bored by repetitive, colourless teaching of Australian history, so there's an obvious opening for livelier accounts of the past, whatever form they take, though not necessarily Manning Clark's own history. When we think about back to the Bligh era, as readers and writers, we need to set aside flip judgments, respect the evidence, and exercise our sympathetic imagination to the full. That's what I've tried to do in Bligh's Daughter.
Thanks. So we come to... Do either of you two want water? And could you get... Yeah, thanks. So we come to question discussion time. And as I said, there are copies of Bligh's Daughter and Colonial Ambition outside. Yeah.
When I started studied history, Australian history, at Sydney University about 50 years ago. I think I was Duncan McKellen.
Wasn't Governor Bligh teaching you?
No.
He wasn't an adjunct professor, was he?
But I came away with a distinct feeling that poor old Bligh was the Democrat who was in favour. And Duncan may not have said this at all. He may not, maybe just all in my head. But he was much more the supporter of the small farmers, the small people, than Democrats against the wily, corrupt, MacArthur mob and the rump people. And, he was, well, I always thought of him as one of the, defenders of democracy against the political coups that go on every now and again in Australian history.
I think, Peter, you read about this recently in the Sydney Morning Herald, didn't you?
You
reviewed a book.
Look, I think that there are many people who feel that way. There are several historians who've written books from that point of view, including Bligh's biographer and most recently the Ross Fitzgerald and his co-author. And it certainly was the view of my father and the people who sent money into the Bulletin. And it's true that he had enormous support among some of the people who were his ideal settlers, the ex-convicts and free settlers up on the Hawkesbury, farming in a small way. About as many people as came up this street here with bayonets, signed a loyal document to Bligh. So even at the time, he had very keen supporters as well as fierce foes.
Peter, do you want to add to that?
Well, since I used to be in that department, I suppose.
Yeah, tell us, this is the Sydney History Department, right?
I don't remember Duncan, but it's certainly true that history is contingent and every generation tells it in a different way. And I think around about the 1930s, there was a move amongst left-wing intellectuals studying Australian history to try and retrieve it from the rather triumphal and uncritical popular histories of the late 19th century and perhaps the early 20th century too. I'm not exactly sure of the detail. But people like Brian Fitzpatrick, the left-winger, civil libertarian, great economic historian, and also Evatt, the Labor leader, when he was a Chief Justice in the 1930s, wrote about Bligh very favourably because they, in a way, were looking for a champion. And they found one, but I think it was taken far too far to call him a Democrat. A Democrat he was. He was less of a Democrat than Wentworth, I think. But that's saying something. But there's no doubt about it. I mean, Bligh did have his instructions and he followed them. And his instructions were to foster small farming. And the small farmers at the Hawkesbury did seem to be very attached to them. It was at Andrew Thompson's house that they gathered. End of the evening. That they gathered to protest against the rebellion against Bligh. And I think under Thompson's guidance, they took up, I'm not sure of the details, I have to ask Paul, they took up a petition in his defence. They did see him as a defender. So in that sense, yes, he was a...
Did I understand you correctly that Bligh was a little bit, at least, anti-democratic? If so, what would he suggest as another political system? If you didn't believe in democracy.
Nobody did in that.
Yeah.
We've gone into seminar mode up here.
Maybe someone should explain what government was in it.
No, but didn't you say he had anti-democratic feelings?
Yes, because...
Well, hang on, Peter. Up here.
Okay.
Well, he was the governor, and it wasn't a democracy at the time, was it? So just explain what government was in the colony of New South Wales in 1806.
Well, in the colony of New South Wales in 1806, government was the governor. He was all-powerful. And back in England, there was nothing remotely like democracy.
Yeah.
What was happening in France was said to be democracy on the march, and that was terrifying. I mean, as late as the mid-19th century, and I've tried to talk about this in some detail in Colonial Ambition, the fear of democracy in the colonies was huge. I mean, the way it was characterised by the Conservatives led by Wentworth, always talking either about Paris in ruins or about America where lynch law prevails. I mean, it was almost as though democracy could be defined quite simply as lynch law. And that's the middle of the 19th century. So there's quite a battle to establish exactly what the meaning of democracy is and its validity, its legitimacy, its value. I mean, the radicals and the liberals in mid-19th century New South Wales had to come from behind. They had to convince the populace that democracy was not satanic. So that part of the battle was a battle about meaning and establishing that democracy was actually a good thing for people. Now, if you go back to 1806, there was really no battle. I mean, there were very few proponents of democracy at that time.
It's almost worth another paper to be written.
Do you want to add to that, Penelope? No, there's a question here. Yeah, Babette.
Peter, I was wondering if you found any evidence that shaped the attitudes of Wentworth and James McArthur as far as the character of those proponents of democracy, particularly the new immigrants like Lowe, Parks, Hawksley. But I mean, how much was Wentworth and MacArthur's attitude, do you think, shaped by thinking deeply about democracy as opposed to reacting to the characters of these newly arrived people? Whether there was some kind of antagonism working, personal antagonism working between the two.
Between Wentworth and MacArthur?
No, Wentworth and MacArthur on the one hand and Lowe, Parks on the other.
Well, there was a great deal of personal antagonism, but I think Henry Parkes was the symbolic equal and opposite of Wentworth. And once Wentworth, who by the 1840s, when Parkes gets going, is a much younger man, or slightly younger man, I think, by that time, Wentworth has recognised that Parkes is immensely politically skilled as a political organiser for Radical Sydney, and also charismatic. I think one of the great things about Parkes that we forget is we've seen that photo of the great beard. And Parkes, when he was young, was absolutely mesmeric. He was incredibly handsome, very captivating, and people spoke about these sort of pale sea blue eyes that sort of washed over you. I mean, you would walk in and somehow be captivated by this personality, and that's political charisma. And he used it as well as his organising skills. And I think the big turning. I think they were fairly confident about things, the colonial conservatives, the great landed people like MacArthur and Wentworth. Keep in mind, they were a long way apart until they had a common enemy that was serious. I think 1848, when the elections don't come out the way, for the Legislative Council, the way they think they should and the way they thought they would, and it's largely because of Parkes' organising skills, they recognise that there is a serious problem, a great obstacle in the way of their plans for self-government in New South Wales in the form of some kind of oligarchy, which certainly Wentworth imagined himself heading up. And from there on, it only gets worse.
Thanks. Hang on just a second. Yes.
Can I ask both of you? I noticed, Peter, you mentioned that, you know, you have to read the fine print, but you do find women involved in these early historical times. But, I mean, where's Elizabeth MacArthur in all this? And did women, looking at Mary, have a chance to be more important in this raw, rugged, less civilised world that they found themselves in, even if they didn't get in the records?
I'm pretty sure that Mary saw a great deal more of a role for herself here as the daughter originally and then as the wife of major people and with a new place where they could kind of invent their own styles of living to a large degree. She certainly didn't want to do what Bly saw as the right thing to do, be returned to her mother. I think a housebound woman in London at the time had far less agency than one in a small town where it was all hands to the wheel. As to whether you find them in the records, you do as soon as you go to the original documents of letters and diaries. You don't when you go to government formal history tends to omit them, but there are plenty of informal documents that show very live wire people. Both Elizabeth Macquarie and Elizabeth MacArthur were very considerable people, and there are books about both of them that bear that out. And indeed, Elizabeth Macquarie virtually designed colonial Sydney and did sketches. You know, Greenway did the architectural design, but she had ideas for Macquarie Street and for the kind of city and for ornate gateways. And other women earlier had established schools, and many, many convict women had succeeded in bettering themselves through either relationships with powerful people or getting into business and running a tavern or some other job once free.
Peter, do you want to add to that? No. Penelope, let's ask about, I think, as I recall, you said that one of the reasons for Governor Bligh's opposition to Mary's second marriage was that he was a Catholic. But then he ends up running the Masonic Lodge. I mean, what...
No, his son.
His son does.
Mm.
Whose son? What?
Mary's son.
Mary and Morris's son.
Okay. So what happens there? I mean, what happens to this Catholic religion that's in the family? It just dissipates, does it? And what was the attitude to Catholics? I mean, there weren't that many of them. I suppose it was, 15% of the settlement? But how did... I mean, obviously Bligh didn't like them, but what was the attitude of MacArthur and others to them all?
I don't really know what MacArthur's attitude to Catholics was. Anybody who wanted to be an observant Christian in 1807 had to go to an Anglican service unless they went to a home service that some Catholics did run from the early times. James Franklin has done some very interesting research on Masons all through the 17th and 18th centuries and 19th century, and he has found that very many Catholics in Ireland and in France were members of lodges well after the first two papal decrees against being both a Catholic and a Mason. I suspect that O'Connell's promotion to IC of Macquarie may have had something to do with his being a fellow Freemason in the first place. Many military men joined lodges, partly because it was, at the time, a kind of way of saying, I'm scientific, I'm modern, I'm not irreligious, but I'm not a sort of flaky worshipper of miracles. I'm more into what science can teach us. And that was the spirit in which many people joined lodges in these earlier times. It changed a lot as attitudes to France changed and in papal antagonism increased.
I actually wanted to ask, what made you decide to write Bligh's daughter as fiction as opposed to narrative?
Because, as Alice in Wonderland said, it's a pity to have a book without pictures and conversation, and I just love the conversation. Once I started looking at the material, I wanted to be free to write the conversation. And also... I don't see myself as an academic historian in any way, and I like writing fiction. But I did enjoy using very, very solid historical research in a way that I hadn't done, although I had set works in the past before.
Tom.
I'm kind of curious about the first year. I mean, there's a sort of consciousness of Bligh is mostly about community in the valley, also in Australia especially. I mean, when you look at the historical record of Bligh in New South Wales and the Second Mutiny, how much does the First Mutiny play into this character formation or play into the reputation that he's buried here and the events of the day?
Certainly people were saying tyrant before he arrived, and the First Mutiny had a lot to do with that. He was, the time that he was really unfortunate in his subordinates was in the supporters of the First Mutineers. Fletcher Christian's brother was a professor of law who never stopped writing tracts and letters to the Times and pamphlets. Young Lieutenant Haywood, originally convicted of mutiny, was taken back into the Navy and rose to be a captain. His links went all the way up to the royal family, and he had extremely influential friends and relations who kept blackening and blackening Bligh. So that by the time Bligh got here, the jokes about... he'd only been here weeks when people were saying, isn't it time he took another little trip in his launch?
Did anyone want to
Well, just the there was just one other comment which I think MacArthur made, which was something like, oh, for a Christian. yeah.
All right. I just wonder, you know, was this such a remarkable event that you had a mutiny on a British ship? I mean, we all hear about it. That's the only mutiny you ever hear about. Was it really remarkable that he had that? Well, there are tons of mutinies, but somehow this one just got a focus on it.
Well, there are more films made about it, I think.
This one was remarkable not just because of the mutiny, but because of Bligh's survival. And the absolutely brilliant escape from the mid-Pacific along the North Australian coast through the Channel and to Timor in a boat that was 18 feet long with 20 people on board and with very limited food. Now, that is a survival story of extraordinary dimensions. So that takes this mutiny, quite apart from the lead up to it, into a different league from other mutinies. Bligh was involved in one at the Nore, there are probably naval experts here who could answer that question. I can't really.
Right, so there's a question right up the back.
What did you say? What did you say? That Bligh, the man, bravely did his in his return to survival. Just to point out, I believe that he was one of Captain Cook's officers. When Captain Cook was a young man, he was a captain and he was getting a lieutenant. Took part in the siege of Quebec and had done a lot of navigation around Nova Scotia. Bligh was his man on board, so he was he had some extremely good privilege in surviving and working on a ship under the British Cook. Comment, no question.
Okay, well, we're getting to the make the last question, Babette.
I wanted to ask Peter, who, as you were listing the things that got Bligh into trouble, it sounded very much to me like a sea captain ordering his quarterdeck. And I wondered to what extent you thought the naval experience really shaped how he behaved on land, but also to what extent it was a clash between soldiers and sailors. Was that of any significance?
The three naval governors, the first non-naval governor is Macquarie, so three naval governors run New South Wales until, 1810, and there's always those traditional tensions. King is the interesting one because they almost got out of hand with him.
Yes.
But he backs off for various reasons about halfway through, I think partly because of his health. This is another factor, they're all sort of old salts wearing out. And, you know, how you, given a limited amount of evidence, how you kind of work in the health factor, Bligh's migraines, he would get the staggers. He had an arm that seized up periodically. I don't know if it was rheumatic or what it was. And a lot of the letters are rich in detail about Bligh's health. Now, whether you can correlate that with his... I don't think you can correlate that the bouts of bad health with his behaviour. And I don't think the army's to blame. Maybe that quarterdeck mentality is the way to explain it. But it seems to me that... I mean, there were lots of captains on ships who didn't behave like that. And even Cook, who could, you know, fly into a rage as easily as anybody. Somehow that's that point that Denning made, that the men couldn't see in the totality of this behaviour a kind of a finessing authority. You know, men on ships in those days could understand and appreciate and accept brutal treatment. And Bligh, by measured against other captains, was not that physically brutal to his troops. But when they couldn't see any sense, when they couldn't see any sense in the authority overall, I think you've got a captain that's starting to lose it. And that's, I guess, the point I made. It's not about soldiers, and it's about the fact, as one of those commentators said, he seemed to lose himself. And this is why, talking to Paul, I keep slipping back to that he's got to be a bit mad position. And Paul says, no, you're not allowed to do that, because it's true, he would never behave like that talking to Sir Joseph Banks. But this idea of him losing himself, and that somehow when he did deal with subordinates in that way, at a certain point he did become unhinged, and yet at the same time he could control that if he was talking to his superior. So how to categorise it and explain it?
So he just kicked down.
Well, what about a bit like Aaron Evans?
Seriously.
And he was well known for throwing his tantrums in his hemisphere office. They never did it.
He never threw a paperweight at the Prime Minister.
No. Or a typewriter. but he would. And I don't think it's very unusual.
But he slammed a hangover of ones that was unhinged in Canberra. Well, there were a lot of unhinged things in Canberra at the time. Penelope, can I just before we lose control of it, Penelope, can I just ask a final question? To some extent, I mean, you and Peter have been demythologising Bligh, and yes, your father was probably the person in the 20th century who most built up the mythology of Bligh. What was it that interested David McNichol in Bligh? Why did he take the stance that he did? Because at the time he took it was a sort of an unusual stance, wasn't it?
It was. If he'd been here, I'm sure he would have been partying with the traders and drinking in the taverns of the rocks and gambling where he could. But he was very much taken with Bligh as a guy who got a raw deal. And I think his view was that this was a decent, hard-working, loyal servant of the Crown carrying out his commission, who was up against entrenched power. And there was entrenched and economic power here that he was up against.
Aye. Penelope wrote a great obituary to the father in the bulletin, as I recall. It's well worth reading. It was.
But it's not online.
Everything from the bulletin's come offline, apparently. And, which is rather sad, because it was a very important publication in its time. Look, we've had a great night. I'm a great admirer of Peter, the historian, and of Penelope, the novelist, and we had them both here today talking about history. Colonial Ambition is a very important book. I've always much admired Peter's book on Simpson, or the Simpson legend. And we've had Penelope here before, and no doubt she'll come back again. So for tonight, I just remind you that the Colonial Ambition and Bligh's Daughter are out, and just to say to our speakers, thanks. We're very happy to publish their papers in the Sydney papers for tonight. Well done. Thank you, Peter.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.